So welcome everybody, and we'll start our third sutta class on the Satipatthana Sutta. And for this session, we will look at the first part of the observing the body section of Satipatthana, and it deals with mindfulness of breathing. And how monastic does a monastic meditate by observing an aspect of the body? Here a monastic has gone to the wilderness or to the root of a tree or to an empty building. They sit down in a meditation posture with their body erect and focus their mindfulness right there. Mindful they breathe in, mindful they breathe out. So this is the basic introduction passage to breath meditation. Most of it, in fact, is a standard introduction to any form of meditation, right? So the bit up to focusing your mindfulness is found in front of just meditation in general, not just specifically Satipatthana meditation or breathing meditation. So just a few things to note here. First thing is the phrase gone to a wilderness, the root of a tree, or to an empty building or empty room, sunyagara, literally an empty garage, right? It's agara, it's the same root as the English word garage. So if you want to get really fundamentalist about it, you can meditate in your garage, okay? Gone to a wilderness, aranyagato, often aranya is translated as forest. But in fact, the way it's used shows clearly what it means is basically any wilderness area. It doesn't have to be a forest. It might be a plains area or a desert or anything like that. So the root of a tree. Okay, so sitting at the base of a tree to meditate. And these are some of the classic, most important places to meditate in the Buddhist texts, and there's a longer list of these meditation places, which also includes like a hillside, a mountain cave, a heap of straw, a charnel ground. Okay, so that's very good. So we have our cemetery next door, so we're very, very lucky that we have all of these places to meditate. And so of course, you know, having a place to meditate is very nice, and you know, if we can find a peaceful place in nature, in a park or somewhere like that, you know, often you know, meditating outdoors can be very wonderful if the weather permits. If you don't have that opportunity, then oh well, you just have to deal with it. That's life. You can't always have a forest handy or a cave handy, so just try to find a place that's reasonably quiet and gives you enough sort of seclusion to be able to meditate without being bothered too much. But one interesting thing about this though is that in these instructions is that meditation usually seems to have been a solitary activity. Right? So they don't have the idea of everyone meditating in groups. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously people did meditate in groups sometimes. There are some passages where it refers to in the suttas. You know, so people would come and maybe the Buddha would give a Dhamma talk and they'd all sit and meditate for a while or something. But obviously it did happen, but the sort of the normal way meditation is presented is you go off and you find somewhere by yourself to meditate. I remember when I was, before I was a monk and I was a guitar player, and when you read books about playing guitar, most books about playing guitar are very kind of sort of nerdy and technical, and it's all about, you know, fingering positions and techniques and doing this and doing that and so on. And but there was one book that I read that was quite interesting. I can't remember the name of the guitarist now, and he wrote much more about the subjective side of playing guitar. And one of the things that he said was that if you want to become a really good guitar player, you just have to learn how to be antisocial. Mm. You have to learn how to just go away into your room and shut the door and just play. And play and play and play, and if you don't enjoy doing that and you don't enjoy being by yourself, then you're never going to get all that far. And I think that's something that's really important to remember for meditation as well. That you have to have the courage to be able to just say to people, I'm sorry, I'm going to go off and do my meditation. And you know, maybe you're, you know, going out to dinner or whatever, or people are coming around or something. Sometimes you're just like, no, I'm just going to shut the door and disappear. Bye bye. And this is my meditation. And it's okay to do that, right? But it doesn't mean you have to do that all the time, right? So it doesn't mean you always have to be antisocial. And there's a time for those things as well. But when it's the time to meditate, don't be ashamed of it. Don't try to, you know. I always think that it's a shame that sometimes Buddhists are not very assertive about these things. Like, mm-hmm. for example, you go to airports around the world, and, you know, there's always like a prayer room, so the Muslims can go and do their prayers. Where's the meditation room, mm-hmm. right? Why don't Buddhists stick up for themselves and say, we need a Buddhist meditation room? Yeah? Some places there are, but most of the time, there isn't. So we sort of got to find our own little space. Yeah. And yeah, that's okay. But there's always sometimes that pull. There's always sometimes people around us have that kind of expectation that we're going to be there, mm-hmm. or there's a feeling like, you know, it's not really the done thing, or that you're kind of a bit weird. I remember my sister said something along those lines once, and she was working for the Labour Party in WA at the time, and she was working for Jeff Gallup, his policy officer. And one time she had to go somewhere in a car with one of the ministers or something like that, and they had to travel somewhere for some meeting or something like that. And when the minister got in the car, he told the driver, you know, can you switch off the music? I want to meditate. Right, so he meditates on the way to his meeting. Right? And my sister would say, oh, you know, that's a bit much, you shouldn't do that. And I said, no, you're wrong. You should be doing that. You should be grateful that you've got a politician who actually cares about having a bit of peace of mind so they can make some decisions with some clarity. And, so, that, you know, good on him. And incidentally, speaking of meditators and good on them, we mentioned yesterday the tennis player whose name I've also forgotten again. What's his name? Djokovic, yeah, he won. Yeah, we'll check the news this morning. So he won at Wimbledon. So there you go. That's what meditation will do for you. Well, there was an article here. They asked him how does he mentally prepare for his matches. And just down the road from Wimbledon, there's a Thai monastery, Wat Buddha Pradipa, which I believe is the same Thai monastery that there was. If I'm right. It's one of the first Thai monasteries in England, and it was the same place that Ajahn Brahm went to when he was a student. And I don't know if you've heard the story about when he was a student, he decided he wanted to be a Buddhist, and he wanted to know what kind of Buddhism to follow. So he went and visited all of the monasteries in London and temples at the time, so this was early 70s, and he said, whoever smiles the most, he's going to follow that tradition. And he went to the Thai monastery, and the Thai monasteries were all smiling. Thai monks were smiling and happy, so he said, okay, I'll go to Thailand and have to fight with them. So anyway, and I think it's the same monastery, and that's where in the interview he was asked, you know, how do you prepare for your matches when you feel tense? He says, I go down to the monastery. It's just around the corner from Wimbledon, apparently. And the monks said, yeah, we see him and here he comes in quite a lot, and you know, we know who he is, but we just sort of leave him alone, and he just comes and spends some quiet time, does some meditation, and goes back. Yeah. Okay, so yes, so if we've got a temple around the corner from us, very good, we can go there and do some meditation. But otherwise we have to make our place somehow. Okay, so then we have the next passage which describes the process of going to meditate. They sit down in the meditation posture. I've translated this a little bit deliberately vaguely because the Pali phrase itself is a bit vague. It says palankanga bhujitva, and it's a little bit uncertain. It's often translated as to sit down cross-legged. But the normal meaning of palanka is not cross-legged. The normal meaning of palanka is a couch. So, meaning you sit down on the sofa. Oh, the people are looking very excited. So,
So for 2,500 years, Buddhists have been forcing themselves to sit cross-legged, and we should have been on the sofa the whole time. Oh my God! Right. So I don't know, by couch doesn't mean like a, you know, necessarily a sofa as comfortable as that one, but they would have been like a some kind of low seat. Low wooden seat with a cushion on it or something, and this is like a palanca. You can see them in the sculptures and things from that time. It's not entirely clear whether this. It's always explained in the commentaries as to sit cross-legged or in lotus position, and obviously that's how you see people meditating. But you also see when the Buddha and so on are depicted meditating, they're usually depicted actually sitting on a seat of some kind, not just sitting on the ground. So it seems to be a little bit unclear exactly what the implication of that is. So that's why I've just translated it as to sit in the meditation posture with their body erect, and they focus their mindfulness right there. And again, another phrase whose general meaning is straightforward, but the exact interpretation is somewhat ambiguous. And again, I've given more of an idiomatic translation, usually translated as establish your mindfulness in front of you. Next, and then it moves on to actually describe the beginning of the mindfulness of breathing practice. Mindful, they breathe in. Mindful, they breathe out. And so this is what I was talking about last night with that description of actually how the practice is undertaken. You know, the word to breathe here is a verb. Yeah? So sato va asati, sato pasasati. Mindful, they breathe in. Mindful, they breathe out. That's right, yeah. This is one of the problems, is that in the previous phrase, is the word parimukha, okay, is explained by the Abhidhamma as meaning at the tip of your nose. Right? And the Abhidhamma Vibhanga actually says nasi kage. So, but it certainly doesn't mean that. For kind of various reasons, okay. What exactly it does mean is not entirely clear. The reason why it's not entirely clear is because the basic word here is mukha, which literally means mouth, but is used in a wide variety of idiomatic ways in Pali. And we already saw one of those yesterday, the word sammukha, like face to face with somebody. So mukha can mean a face, it can mean as a mouth, it can also mean an entrance, right? It can mean a cause of something. It can mean many, many different kinds of things. So the word parimukha, curiously enough, only occurs in one other place in the Pali canon, where it's in the Vinaya, and it says that the monks are not allowed to shave their face parimukha. So you're not allowed to have a beard that is parimukha. Okay, so whatever kind of beard it means, probably it means you're not allowed to shave so that you have only your hair around your mouth. In that case, literally probably means around your mouth, this word, literal meaning of parimukha. So perhaps that means here, focus your mindfulness around your mouth, or focus your mindfulness on your beard, I don't know. So it's a little bit unclear, but for my research in that, what I found was that there's a Sanskrit variant whose meaning seems to mean presence. Okay? And so I think it actually doesn't really mean anything at all. I think it's just another synonym for mindfulness. And so it's just this kind of idiom where you repeat it for emphasis. And so really all it's saying is that you should focus your mindfulness, or you should be mindful, or you should have a presence of mindfulness, or something like that. So I don't think it's, as I said, it commonly appears in front of any kind of meditation, so like Brahma Vihara meditation, or just abandoning the hindrances, or any kind of meditation. So it obviously doesn't mean like a, you know, specifically at the tip of your nose or something like that. So this is why I just sort of translated it more idiomatically rather than giving it a literal translation. Okay, so but the upshot of that is that yes, there's no real instructions in the suttas that tell you that you should focus at a particular place. And again, you know, that to me, that's very, very much in tune with the overall way that the mindfulness of breathing is taught in the suttas, which is, you know, is a, as a process. It's as understanding and knowing and being aware of that process of meditation of breathing. Okay. Good. Yeah. Come on. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, except that's not what one-pointedness means, unfortunately. Yeah, look, it's just a method, so, you know, just treat it as a method. If you find it's useful, that's good, but it's not like it has to be that way. But the word one-pointedness is another one of these very, very misleading phrases. The word that it's translated as one-pointed doesn't mean one-pointed at all. But the Pali word is chittas ekagata, so ekagata. And the problem is that the word agra, again, is ambiguous. Sometimes it means a point or a peak, right? But in other places, and very, very commonly, in fact, normally, the word agra means best, yeah, or highest. Yeah? And so what it actually means, what ekagata means, is not like one, you know, like one point as in, you know, one thing, but it means that there's like a transcendent unity, something like that. And there's so many places in the suttas where it makes it very clear that state of unification is vast, right? All of these words that's used to describe it, vipala is vast, mahagata, growing great, apamana is measureless, right? So all of these words which clearly mean that it's a vast, open state of mind, and is very, as far as you can imagine, from being, you know, one-pointed in that kind of sense.
Yeah. I remember reading another translation of the Panatha as Tetrance Alpha.
The gone to oneness,
is that
spell? Yeah, ekagata. It can probably be read that way. I don't think so, though. It's got two G's in there, and I don't see why it would have two G's if it was gata. Yeah, gata doesn't have a. Normally, in Pali, if you compound a word, you can sometimes double the initial consonant. But you usually only double the initial consonant if there's a reason to do that. And often the reason might be that there's a missing doubled consonant from the Sanskrit form or something like that. So there are specific reasons why. And I'm not sure, I don't think that would apply in this case. So I think it does mean eka aga ta. Yeah. Eka gata. If it was eka gata, meaning it would seem, again, you could translate it as gone to oneness. But actually, the suffix gata, I'm just thinking about it. The suffix gata, it gets a very idiomatic suffix, but it really just means in the state of something like that. Just so eka gata, that's what it meant, would just mean unified, essentially. Yeah. I have to come back to that. Maybe gata does take a double G in some compounds. Maybe I'll look that up later. I'll come back to it. Anyway. Okay. So let's have a look. So this is the basic introduction to mindfulness and breathing meditation. And we then begin the 16 steps. Okay, so these are the famous 16 steps organized in terms of four tetrads, except we only have the first four of these 16 steps here in the Satipatthana Sutta. This is pretty much the only place in the whole canon where we have only these four steps. Everywhere else, breath meditation is taught in terms of the 16 steps, and those 16 steps correspond with the four kinds of Satipatthana, right? Four kinds of mindfulness meditation. So the first four steps, mindfulness of the body, second four, mindfulness of feelings, the third four, mindfulness of the mind, and the last four is mindfulness of principles. Okay? So in the Satipatthana Sutta itself, we only have the first four dealing with mindfulness of the body for reasons which the sutta doesn't explain. So one could speculate about that, but in any case, the main upshot of that is that what we're presented here in the study of the Tathagata Sutra is essentially the fundamentals of breathing meditation. Okay, so it's the kind of the practical basis of breathing meditation. Okay, so let's have a look at what it says. Breathing in deep, they clearly know I'm breathing in deep. Breathing out deep, they clearly know I'm breathing out deep. Breathing in shallow, they clearly know I'm breathing in shallow. Breathing out shallow, they clearly know I'm breathing out shallow. They practice like this. I'll breathe in, experiencing the whole breath. They practice like this. I'll breathe out, experiencing the whole breath. They practice like this. I'll breathe in, stilling the breath energies. They practice like this. I'll breathe out, stilling the breath energies. It's like a skilled carpenter or a carpenter's apprentice. When making a deep cut, they would clearly know I'm making a deep cut. And when making a shallow cut, they would clearly know I'm making a shallow cut. In the same way, when a monastic is breathing in deep, they clearly know I'm breathing in deep. Breathing out deep, they clearly know I'm breathing out deep. Breathing in shallow, they clearly know I'm breathing in shallow. Breathing out shallow, they clearly know I'm breathing out shallow. They practice like this. I'll breathe in, experiencing the whole breath. They practice like this. I'll breathe out, experiencing the whole breath. They practice like this. I'll breathe in, stilling the breath energies. They practice like this. I'll breathe out, stilling the breath energies. In this way, they meditate by observing an aspect of the body internally. They meditate by observing an aspect of the body externally. They meditate by observing an aspect of the body internally and externally. They meditate by observing the reasons for the origination of the body. They meditate by observing the reasons for the dissolution of the body. They meditate by observing the reasons for the origination and dissolution of the body. Or mindfulness is established that there is a body to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness. They meditate independent, not grasping at anything in the world. This too is how a monastic meditates, by observing an aspect of the body. Okay, so let's have a look at each section of these in turn. So the first section, or really the first two sections, should be taken together, is breathing in deep, breathing out deep, breathing in shallow, and breathing out shallow. So this is obviously not giving sort of instructions that you should be, you know, making yourself breathing in deeply and breathing out deeply and so on, but it's just giving a description of what happens in meditation, right? Because that's what happens. Right? You come, you sit down to meditate, and when you first sit down to meditate, your breathing tends to be a little bit more coarse, a little bit, you know, a little bit more ragged. You need more oxygen, okay, both for your body and also for your brain, right? So your brain is running around at a million miles an hour, and brains consume a lot of oxygen, right? And so that your breathing has to be somewhat deep to be able to supply the oxygen for that. And as you sit there, quite naturally, your breathing will slow down and become more subtle and become more soft, okay? That happens even pretty much even if you're not even really meditating, right? I mean, even you just sit there and just relax, and then your breathing will calm down a little bit, yeah? So this is just becoming aware of that process, just an ordinary physical process as you're sitting there, becoming more peaceful, then your breath gradually starts to become a bit shorter. Okay? Any questions on this one? No? Right. So, the next two, a little bit more subtle to interpret. The third step, I'll breathe in, experiencing the whole breath. I'll breathe out, experiencing the whole breath. Now, the important thing about this stage, the third stage, is the word sabba. Okay? The word sabba is whole, right? It's all. And so we're moving towards an experience of wholeness. Yeah? And think about what that means when you meditate, that your mind is fractured, right? Thinking about this, thinking about that, feelings pulling you this way, feelings pulling you that way, sensations in the body, yada yada yada, all these things happening, right? And that through the breath, even the breath when we begin is a bit kind of ragged, a bit all over the place and so on. But as we sit there longer, the breath becomes smoother, it becomes more silky, it becomes more peaceful, and the experience becomes more of a whole experience. Okay? You're actually in there and everything is coming together. that's the important part of this. And I think that it's a bit unfortunate that that is sometimes forgotten, because there is a dispute about exactly how this section is to be interpreted. And so most of the discussions that I've seen about this have focused on either one of these two interpretations. And I don't think that it matters all that much personally which interpretation you take in this case, because I don't think that's the point. So the interpretive problem is that does kaya here, does body, mean like your actual body, right? So you're sitting there breathing and being aware of your whole body, or does it mean the body of your breath? Okay, so remember that we looked at that idiom, kaya kaya anupasi, one observes a body in the body. Okay, and so when it uses the word kaya in this kind of context, what it means is a particular aspect of your body. And the aspect of the body that we're dealing with here as breath meditation, obviously, is the breath. Right? So this is one interpretation, is to say that the whole body means that you're focusing on the whole breath. Right? So it means you're looking at like the continuity of the breath as it's coming in and coming out, so you're getting more of a full experience of your whole breath. The other school of interpretation of this says that no, it means you feel your whole body, literally, breathing in, breathing out. And so like I said, I don't think from the Pali that there's a definitive answer to this. I suspect that the interpretation that it's the whole breath is what it meant, I suspect that that's the correct interpretation, but I don't think that it's definitive in this case, and I, practically speaking, I don't think that it matters all that much. I know plenty of meditators practice in both of those ways, and they seem to get good results. I've done it both ways, and it seems to work pretty well either way, as I can see, so I'm not particularly fussed about saying one way is right or one way is wrong in this particular case. Yes, Kate?
Do you actually feel breath through the whole entire body,
like
as you're feeling,
yeah.
Feeling the whole body breathing, but feeling the breath through the whole body?
Yeah, well, I think those two things come together, right? I mean, I think you feel, you know, you do feel like an energy or a rhythm that you know, as your mind becomes more subtle, you actually feel that energy, you know, sort of pulsing through your whole body, and you feel the breath going through there. So yeah, you can. In the Upanishadic tradition is more explicit about that. It actually has a sort of classification of different kinds of breath, like breath moving up and breath moving down and breath moving through the limbs and these kinds of things. It talks about that a few times in the suttas as well. But clearly they were thinking of breaths as being different energies which are moving through the limbs and parts of the body. Yeah. Yeah, look, it doesn't really matter. I mean, technically, the Mahasi people say that what they're teaching is not anapanasati. Okay, the technical understanding of it, according to their system, is that it's a watching the air element rather than watching anapanasati as such. But whether that's a meaningful distinction, I'm not sure. But yeah, look, some people I know watch the breath at the belly, some tip of the nose, some just watch it without focusing on any particular place. And I think any way can work. It doesn't really matter. Yeah.
When you talk about meditation, you talk about the present. Mm. What is this point of that I will begin? So that is in the future?
It is actually, it's a good point, it's an interesting point, because the Pali is phrased in a future tense, and so that's why you translate it in that way. As to why it's like that? Yeah, in the first couple it's in the present tense, and then there's later on it's I will breathe in. Yeah. Training, yeah. Again, it's only sort of nuance to do. So to me, the idea behind practicing basically is just you just keep on doing it again and again.
The training sort of allows you to bring that element to position. So when you sit there, unless you're a natural, it took a long time for it to settle down. Once you get that position, my intention when I sit down is to train. For that time. And I remember going through bit by bit, this is the beginning of my breath. This is the end of my breath. This is the end of my breath. Because I could never, I've realized I could never see the whole breath.
Right.
Just completely no idea when it began and when it finished.
Right.
So that was just the thing to so that was a lot of training.
About what? Right. That's right. That's right. You know, when you begin, your mind scattered, your attention scattered, and even if you catch your breath, you usually only catch a bit of it, right? You sort of glimpse it in passing, you know. And so this is what this stage is talking about. It's more like, oh, you're feeling the full thing, yeah. Yes, I mean you can help to do that. One way of doing that by sort of bringing attention to the, as I said, to the beginning, the middle, and the end, right? So you notice that first moment when your breath starts. And you notice the quality of the breath as it's flowing past, and then you notice that moment when it finishes. So that helps with your sampajanya, with your clear awareness. Okay. So, but yeah, just to come back to that main point I made earlier, rather than thinking, you know, like I said, I don't think that there's just one way of reading this, but the main point here is that we're moving towards the wholeness of experience. Okay, the last headboard, or the last section, they practice like this. I will breathe in, stilling the breath energy. So practice like this, I'll breathe out, stilling the breath energy. And so the Pali term here is prasambhayam kaya sankharam. And word I've translated with breath energy is kaya sankhara. And again, this is a somewhat tricky one to translate. Kaya sankhara, kaya meaning body, sankhara meaning energy or activity. However, with this particular case, unlike the previous one where I said that there's no real way of determining exactly what it means, in this particular case, the suttas do say what this means, and elsewhere in the suttas it says that kaya sankhara in this context just means the in-breathing and the out-breathing, okay? So it specifically means the breath energies. And so what it's talking about here, and again I think it's something which hopefully when you read that is clear what it actually means when for a meditator, right? That when your breath has, you know, you've gone through that initial calming of the breath through the first couple of stages and the breath has become more subtle. And then there's that wholeness, so you feel, okay, you sort of have that whole awareness of the breath coming in and out. And then as your breath becomes much more subtle still, you can see like these kind of subtle energies and so on inside the breath, right? And so the energy itself is a breath the breath itself is an energy. And it fluctuates and it varies, and inside there's these little kind of movements and little activities of what we call sankharas happening along there. And so as you practice and through this stage, you can see that energy of the breath is gradually becoming more and more and more and more subtle. Okay. Now they say that process culminates in the fourth jhana. Okay. So the perfection of this stage is fourth jhana, where your breath stops completely. Alright? So if you're ever like stuck in a submarine at the bottom of the ocean or something like that, and you need to survive without oxygen, then fourth jhana, okay, you'll be fine. Or if you're like in space or something like that, right? And then we're losing oxygen, we're losing oxygen, you just tell everyone, don't worry, just get the fourth jhana, you'll be right.
Well, we have stilling there, actually, sounds quite active.
Yeah, it's again grammatically. That's the form that is in the Pali. It's a present participle. So literally, it's stilling the breath or quieting the breath or something like that.
No.
I think it's just an idiom. Yeah, but I know what you mean. I thought of translating it differently. If you translate it, you know, breathe in and out as the breath becomes still or something like that.
Say you can't feel your breath anymore.
Yep.
And you know that you're definitely not in fourth jhana.
Okay. Either it means either it means that you've just basically there's a pause in your breathing, which can happen, and so your mind becomes very still. So sometimes you just pause for a while. And the breathing doesn't come, so it becomes very slow. But otherwise, yes, it can happen that it just drops, the subtlety of the breathing drops below the threshold of awareness. Now, what happens in your meditation is there's like a kind of a balancing that occurs between, on the one hand, the tranquility, and on the other hand, the brightness and the energy. So if the energy and the brightness of your mind sort of drops a little bit too low and the tranquility is a bit too strong, then that's what can happen. So you sort of, the breath disappears for a while. Sometimes when that happens, you can panic. This fear will come up, and that's really good, actually. Yeah. So that's fear of death, is that you know if I don't breathe, I'm going to die. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, this is where these things are uncovering themselves, right? You know, so we talked before about how when you're doing this meditation, it's just you're just doing a calming meditation, right? It's like a samatha practice, but then that wisdom or that insight, it comes up. You're not looking for it, you're not trying, you're not doing anything, but suddenly it comes up. Well, there's fear, and you realize, all this time I'm holding on to this attachment to life, and there it is. Yeah. And so best thing to try to do at that stage, don't breathe, don't do anything. Just sort of watching that, especially in that space where the breath has disappeared. And you're just watching, you stay there and just watch, it's just nothing. And you say, okay. It's blackness and void and empty. And I'm perfectly happy then.
But what if your
you're saying that the brightness of the mind is not attached to the tranquility. Yeah.
So
you
try and
doing
things to make your mind.
No. No need. At that point, no need, because it's very subtle. Where your mind is at is very subtle. So the balance will come naturally. Just be patient. Yeah. If it's like earlier in your meditation and your mind's maybe more coarse and the sloth and torpor is quite strong, and then maybe you might want to open your eyes or go for a walk or something to brighten your mind up. But at that point, no, you just wait and just allow it to happen. Sometimes it won't work. Sometimes maybe your energy will just leak out of your mind and you might fall asleep or something like that. It doesn't really matter. You just keep on being patient and then try it again next time and next time, and then eventually you'll find that brightness comes back in and you find that balance, right? But the real balance only comes when you're letting go. And so if you're trying to control the experience at that point, even subtly, then it won't happen. Right? Okay.
good. Is the translation of breath energies, is that a good translation for that? I sort of explained what it means. Is that a good way of expressing that?
I didn't like the one I first read.
You got a preference?
Unfortunately.
it didn't
mean anything to me.
It's hard to find one that...
Do you have any other
sentences?
Not often you read them.
Breath activities, or just breath? You say just calming the breath.
Subtle energies.
Subtle yoga. I mean, that's what it means. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
The deviation
of the breath. Not really. Not at that point.
What is
usually
translated? It's
still embodied,
isn't it?
How it's usually translated? Let me see how it translates it. It translates it as bodily formations or something. I shall breathe in tranquilizing the bodily formation. Hopefully we're moving in the right direction anyway. Yeah. I think he's probably revised that translation in more recent ones, but that's what it was in the Majjhima anyway. Sorry, what? Yeah. No, Sanya. Sanya means perception, yeah?
So
Sorry?
I was just wondering if the condition of the breath is different.
No. That's you're thinking of sanya. Okay. So sankhara means, and different context means different things. The most general meaning of sankhara is condition or conditioned phenomena, but it commonly means intention or volition. Yeah. And but it can also basically refers to any kind of conditioned process. Yeah? So here it means just that. That here, what it's pointing to is that the breathing is like a function of the body, the physical function. Mm.
So, what's the significance of sankhara being used at that point compared to earlier?
I think what it's doing is it's only a nuance, right? So the way that the sutras work is that they're frequently in different places. They'll use words which are basically synonyms, but they have like a slightly different connotation in different places. Sometimes it doesn't actually matter much. Sometimes it's just, variant synonyms, but sometimes it does. Sometimes there's a nuance of meaning that you can discern there. And so kaya sankhara to me has a more kind of technical flavor, and it ties what's happening with the kind of the broader sweep of Buddhist teachings about conditions, cessation, about that whole process of meditation, like in the synonym for Nibbana, Sabba Sankhara Samato, the tranquilizing of all sankharas, right? So I think it's kind of reminding you or bringing in that idea that what's ceasing here are some of these conditions, right? Which is leading to, in that way, towards Nibbana. And so it's in a way sort of connecting, like the sankhara is like connecting it with the conditions in your mind and body more generally. Yeah.
I think it's good that you have energy here in terms of being able to speak, like that's a good meditation instruction for people who are getting deeper to go into seeing the breath of energy.
Yeah.
So I just thought now, maybe instead of having energy, you just have energy,
it is actually singular in the Pali, so maybe we say breath energy. You think breath, just breath energy would be
like breath and energy, from that in between, and you're going there,
Okay, well, bear that in mind, sounds good. Any other thoughts?
What's breath process?
Breath process, yeah, is another way you could do it. Yeah. Process is quite a good translation for sankhara. Yeah.
Breath process.
The whole of meditation in some places the Buddha called anupubha nirodha, is the gradual cessation. Okay, so that's the section on breathing. Let's finish up the class today by looking at the what we call the refrain. And so the refrain or refrains, these few paragraphs at the end, which are repeated with every different meditation. And as I mentioned before, this particular part, in some respects, I think is quite late in terms of the editing. And it varies a lot between the different versions. I might, maybe in another class I might bring in the, have a look at some of the other versions and see what they say. But it's very, very noticeable. You know, what you find is like that teaching on the breath meditation itself is exactly the same. Right? So they have all the different versions and the actual breath meditation is identical. And then it'll come to this refrain section at the end and it'll be completely different in all the different versions. Or some of them might have something in common, but they might be quite different as well. So this is one of the reasons why it has some signs of being a sort of later edit, later addition. But in addition to that, it also has some editing problems, which I'll sort of mention a bit later on. Anyway, so let's have a look at the first part. The first part of this is in fact the part which is, I think, most likely to be authentic and quite probably was the original text here. In this way they meditate by observing an aspect of the body internally, externally, and internally and externally. Now this is something which is found very, very commonly in the context of meditation right throughout the suttas, especially in Satipatthana meditation, but also many other kinds of meditation as well. And I think it's interesting that it's obviously a very significant aspect of meditation, and yet it's one which is rarely talked about. And in fact, the way that we talk about meditation these days is almost entirely, you know, we say meditation is about not being external, it's about focusing internally, right? And yet here in the suttas we find that actually both of these aspects are acknowledged, and I think this is quite interesting. What this exactly means in the context of meditation is not entirely clear, right? So what does it mean to contemplate the breath? Well, to contemplate the breath internally, I think, okay, we're breathing, right? You feel it, pretty straightforward, right? So the word internal, that's translated, is literally is ajahata, which it literally means inside yourself, okay? Bahidha is outside, so it means in this body and outside this body, right? So does that mean that we're contemplating the breath of other people? So you can sit there in meditation and you can sort of quietly listen to the person next to you breathing and you're like, oh, okay, their meditation's going really well today, I can hardly hear the breathing at all. Does it mean that? Maybe, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly how beneficial that's going to be. In some places, though, it does actually explain what this is, and and it's one of those things which it makes sense. It makes obvious sense in certain kinds of contexts. So, for example, in the charnel ground meditations, which we'll look at later, it talks about comparing your body with the body which is decomposing in the cemetery, right? It says, you know, just as that body is, you know, decaying and falling apart, so too this body will suffer the same fate, right? And so there, it's very clear that's exactly what it means. It's internally and externally. You're actually contemplating a body outside yourself and the body in here. Similarly with the contemplation of elements, you can do it the same way. So you're contemplating the elements inside and outside. So in those cases, I think it's fairly straightforward what it means. In the context of breath meditation, it doesn't seem to have such an obvious application. Although I think, as I mentioned last night, it is the case that when you're breathing, you're actually breaking down that boundary between the internal and the external. Your breath actually is on that border. What is inside goes outside. What is outside comes inside. And notice that in that series, okay, the movement, right? You see, we contemplate internally, contemplate externally, you contemplate internally, externally. Right? So the movement is towards breaking down the division between internal and external. Right? The movement is towards synthesis. Okay? And of course this is part of that whole thing of conditionality, connection, not self, all of these things. Right? And so just as, again it's done quite explicitly if you're doing like the symmetry contemplations where you're explicitly saying this body is the same as that body. And similar thing in breath meditation, even though you're not necessarily reflecting on it or it's not explicitly a part of your meditation, but sort of subliminally, as you're meditating, what's inside becomes outside, what's outside becomes inside. And the difference between those things is actually dissolving as you're meditating. And that's something which you experience as you meditate and you go further and further into meditation, almost paradoxically, you begin by meditating. When you first begin to meditate, there's almost like this sort of stark duality between your experience, I mean here, and the world outside. But the further you go inside, it's almost like that begins to fade away. It's just your mind. It's just the experience. It's just what's happening. And you sort of go inside that experience and that difference between self and other, inside and outside, that gradually kind of falls away. Which is, I think, part of that whole experience of oneness or the experience of wholeness, which we talked about already. So I think it's that's what it's getting at with this teaching of internally, externally in this context. Yeah.
Well, sometimes I sort of imagine myself like going outside of myself,
okay.
Like just observing. Almost as if I feel like I'm not myself, but like I'm watching myself from outside myself when I meditate.
Right.
Is that like a dissociation?
No, I don't think so. These are just kind of shifts in perception and so on.
Seems to help.
Okay. Yeah, maybe you can get a bit of distance. But I think that's fine. Anything like that is fine. As long as you're aware of what's going on, if it's happening compulsively, so some people can have like out-of-body experiences which get like completely out of control and they can just, sit down to meditate or something like that and feel like their body sort of slips out and goes somewhere else and they don't know what's happening. So that's obviously something to, that's kind of a good sign. But as long as you're aware of what's going on and you're mindful, then that's okay. Yeah. Like what, sorry?
The sensations that you see outside, like feeling,
okay, yeah. Ah, okay. Yeah. I mean, if it's happening inside your body, it's internal. Yeah. The distinction is not entirely as simple as that, but generally speaking, that's the easiest way to think of it. Yeah. Okay. Next one, they meditate by observing the reasons for the origination, dissolution, and origination and dissolution. So, the Pali here, Samudaya Dhamma Anupassi,
This is again somewhat been translated in a number of different ways, and the reason here is because it uses the word dhamma as a suffix, right? So it has samudaya dhamma, which usually, when dhamma is used as a suffix in that way, it usually means something like has the nature of or is subject to. Okay, so I think Bhikkhu Bodhi is subject to origination, or perhaps has the nature of origination, or something like that. Which is fine, but I think it's unclear exactly what the thing is talking about. Right? What the passage means is that you look at what is the reasons for why the body originates. Okay, that's the actual meaning of it. So it doesn't just so there's two different aspects here. Okay, one is watching something rising and falling. Okay. Right? So you watch something is there and then it's not there. Okay, so this is like a straightforward observation. You're looking at what the facts are. Something's not there, it's there, and then later on it isn't. Right, but then there's the other aspect, which is the understanding. Why is that the case? Right, what's the reason why it arises? What's the reason why it disappears? Right, and that's where it goes into the deeper insight. I mentioned yesterday we discussed this a little bit. I think the day before now we discussed this a little bit. In the context of Dhammanupassana, the observation of principles. And so that's what Dhamma means in that case, I think, is it means the principles. What's the underlying causal situation? What's going on there? And so that's what I think that the Dhamma means here. Samudaya, as the word in Buddhism, of course, is extremely well known and well understood, is the second noble truth, right? So the second noble truth is understanding what's the reason for suffering. Okay? It's not just saying suffering's not there and then it is there and then it's not there, right? It's not just observing rise and fall in that way, but it means understanding why is suffering there, why is it not there. Right? And so that's what this passage here is getting at. So that's why, rather than just translating it as sort of observing the nature of origination or something, but you try to draw the meaning out a bit more explicitly, observing the reasons for the origination, the reasons for the dissolution, and the reasons for the origination and dissolution of the body. So the origination and dissolution obviously happen. These are, if you like, fractal phenomena. Okay, so origination and dissolution happen at any scale, and if you look at, say, the smallest scale that we're aware of, the quantum scale, you sort of go down into the vacuum. And you see there's nothing there except stuff pops in and out of existence all the time in a vacuum. It's madness. What's going on, right? There's nothing there. And then particles appear and they disappear. And nothingness is a seething hive of activity, right? It's crazy. And where is it all coming from, right? So even at that smallest level that we're able to discern actually is full of activity. And then when if you kind of zoom out past the human level and then go up to the cosmic level or the galactic level, it's the same thing, isn't it, right? Universes, galaxies come into existence and disappear, universes come into existence and disappear, and we're not exactly sure how it happens. The popular theory these days is that we're headed for a big rip. We used to be headed for the big crunch when the universe would come in and collapse in on itself. But now they think, because of the influence of dark energy, that we're going to go ahead for a big rip and the universe is going to tear itself into bits. I don't know which is more appealing. At least if you have a big crunch, at least you can say, well, you know, I'll be there with my friends at that time when we get squashed into a pinhead of nothingness and disappear. But with a big rip, you're like, yeah, it's all pretty lonely out there. But you know, this is all still dependent on, you know, little minor details of explanation. Like the universe is like 70 or 80% dark matter, and we haven't got a clue what dark matter is, right? So it's not entirely settled. An anecdote that I tell sometimes about this was when we did the Bhikkhuni conference in Hamburg.
it's really apropos of nothing, but anyway, it's a funny story. We were at the Bikuni conference in Hamburg with the Dalai Lama, and the Chancellor of Hamburg University is talking about this, and he's saying, you know, giving an example of how times are changing and how our universe is very different from how we think it is. And he said, and scientists have revealed that the university is comprised of 70% dark matter. Which I think was a very revealing Freudian slip there. So, anyway, so right, so that big scale, right? Everything's falling apart as well. So, and also, of course, on our living scale, on our human scale, right? Our bodies are born, get old, and they die. And that's the basic paradigm. If we're understanding what this means, origination and dissolution of the body, what it basically means is that you're going to get born and you're going to die. Okay? That's the primary meaning of impermanence of the body in Buddhism. Okay? Now, of course, impermanence doesn't just happen at that level. It happens everywhere you look. So if you want to look at moment to moment, yes, of course, it's rising and falling and changing moment to moment as well, right? If you want to look from one day to the next or over a period of years, okay? Any way you look at it, any context, any framework, any perspective, you will always see this impermanence and this change of the body. Now, within this particular context, we're looking at the breath, okay? And then, of course, you're seeing the conditionality of the breathing, in a sense. You know, the breath is rising and falling every time that you breathe, right? You breathe in and then that finishes. You breathe out, that finishes. You breathe in, that finishes. You breathe out, that finishes. So that impermanence is happening all the time. As you proceed and as your awareness of your breathing deepens, that awareness of impermanence will shift and you'll see it in multiple different ways as your practice goes on. Right? Sometimes you'll see that inside your breathing itself, right? So you might, while the breathing is coming in, you'll see all of this, the conditions, the sankharas, the energies in that breath, just falling over themselves, right? The whole thing is just collapsing in on itself as you while you're watching it, it's just falling to bits. And that will happen. And another way you might experience it is what we were talking about before, when the breath just comes to an end. Right? And you're just watching the breathing and then suddenly it's just not there. Right? And you're like, where did that go? And so on. So there can be many, many different ways that truth of impermanence will present itself to your mind. Okay? Now, in Buddhism we have like a pragmatic approach to truth. Right? It doesn't matter particularly how that happens. And if we look through the suttas, and we look at especially the Theravada, at the accounts of how different monks and nuns get enlightened and so on, then it happened in all kinds of different circumstances, right? And it's not like there's one way that it has to be. And, you know, very famous stories of where, like, the bhikkhuni will, Bhadra Kundala Kesar, and she just washed her feet, and then she watched the water disappear into the ground. And when she saw that, the mind is free. Yeah? So it's just not, and that's impermanence. That's seeing impermanence in that disappearing of the water. Yeah, and that impermanence is just as meaningful and just as profound as the impermanence of quantum phenomena, or the impermanence of the universe, or the impermanence of your body. Right? It's all just impermanence. So it doesn't matter where you see it, right? What manner you see it, right? It's whether you let go, and you see that and you let go. Yeah.
So we like in those circumstances, like you hear, oh, they saw this impermanence in this particular context. But surely that happened because there was a build up of many times of them seeing impermanence, and maybe that's the one.
Sure.
Is that how it works?
Sure. Yeah. That's right. I mean, wisdom comes from all kinds of things, yeah. And but the point simply is that the wisdom that matters is the one that leads you to letting go. Okay?
There's no hierarchy of significance in
the exactly.
One free thing can be this minuscule or that.
That's right.
Any
yeah.
Any energy, any volume.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The only thing that matters is, do you let go? You know, do you let go? And there's some nice stories, a nice story about that in the commentary, where it's talking about the commentary to the precept on not listening to music. And it gives a story of a monk who's walking for alms around in the village, and he hears a slave woman singing about the sufferings of life. Okay? So Buddhists therefore invented the blues. Right? I mean, come on. What else can it be, right? So they're going in, going for alms round to hear someone singing the blues. Oh, my man, you done gone, left me. I'm so lonesome. And then his mind was freed. Huh? And he's like, yeah? Because it makes you reflect. Yeah? So it doesn't matter where it comes from, where the insight comes from, or where the wisdom comes from. It matters what does it lead you to letting go. Now, I said that, well, one of my problems with this text, and particularly with the Satipatthana Sutta in the Pali version, is that this teaching on impermanence is there, okay? Of course, there's nothing wrong with it having that there, right? I mean, of course, the teaching of impermanence is so important to Buddhism, it should be everywhere, right? But normally when breath meditation is presented, the teaching of impermanence comes in the fourth tetrad, okay? So the beginning of the Dhammanupassana section, the fourth tetrad, the ending of breath meditation, Anicca-anupassi, yeah? So one breathes in, contemplating impermanence, you breathe out, observing impermanence, yeah? Impermanence, letting go, fading away, cessation, and leading to Patinissaka-anupassi, letting go. Yeah? So this is, and that's the outcome, the relinquishment, the letting go. So that doesn't mean that, you know, it always has to be at the end, or it always has to be at the beginning, or anything like that. Actually, these are just texts, okay? When we're reading them, they're just texts, that's all. So don't over-determine them. Don't try to make the text into something which is more than it actually is, right? It's just there to try to help us to be more mindful, to have that experience, and to be able to let go. So when you're doing the breath meditation, you know, if that impermanence, you know, starts to become aware to you, great. You know, don't worry, is it should be here or should it be there or be like this. If you're understanding impermanence, fantastic, that's what it's all about. Yeah? And so you understand that. Yeah? But the only thing is just to bear in mind that understanding of impermanence, okay, will become deeper and deeper as your peace of mind becomes deeper. Okay? What you think right now is a great insight into impermanence, okay, is going to be very shallow compared to the insight that comes from a deep state of peace of mind. Okay? So just be patient, right? Give yourself plenty of time for the mind to become peaceful. Okay? And remember also, another very important thing about this process of meditation is that the very process of becoming peaceful itself is impermanence. Okay? Your breath is changing. It's long breath and the short breath. That's impermanent. As the breath is filling during your meditation, it is impermanent. And you are just watching that all the way through. Okay? And so it's natural that as you watch that process that your mind will deepen its understanding of this. Okay? Impermanence is a two-edged sword. Right? On the one hand, it's scary because you're going to die, right? And that is scary, and you should be scared, right? On the other hand, you're also letting go of suffering, right? And that's not scary at all. But through both of those kinds of impermanence, we tend to be scared at. We're scared because we're going to die, right? And we're scared of letting go of attachments, right? But being scared that you're going to die in a way that's a rational fear, okay? Right? If you're going to be scared of anything, that's probably what you should be scared of. Yeah? But being scared of being enlightened, there's nothing to be afraid of. Yeah? It's just the end of suffering. Yeah.
Would you say that once you start seeing impermanence more and more, that actually helps you to meditate for the next time?
Absolutely, yeah. Definitely, yeah. This is something that I learned many years ago. One of the first teachings I ever heard from Ajahn Brahm, he said, you know, someone asked him about the Samatha Vipassana, and he said, if you're, how do you know whether you're meditating right? He said, if your samatha, if your peace of mind lets you see the truth more clearly, right? So if your samatha increases your vipassana, then it's right samatha.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And if your vipassana, if your wisdom leads to your mind becoming more peaceful, then it's right wisdom. Yeah? That's how these things should always work together. Yeah.
In the last paragraph it says, mindfulness is established that there is a body.
We're just about to come on to that one.
Oh, sorry. Oh,
no, you're right.
I thought we've already been there.
No.
Oh. Sorry.
No, do not be sorry, be joyful.
The question the question was about the previous paragraph, actually.
Okay.
It's really infinity as a concept.
Uh-huh.
Is that what we see behind the origin of dependent origination?
Crikey, do we see infinity?
Yeah, because I'm thinking like a child, because if I was reading this to a child would say, they meditate by observing the reasons for the origination of the body, for the solution of the body, but why is there origination of the body and the solution of the body?
Well, ultimately because of craving.
Is it?
Yeah. Ultimately, the body, you know, on one level, originates and dissolves because of craving. But at a Dhamma level, at a more profound level, it dissolves because you end craving.
Oh,
when you end craving, the body ends completely. Otherwise, it just ends conditionally, right? One body ends and another body is taken up.
So that applies to human life and animal life,
yes.
But not to the galaxies.
Well, that's an interesting question, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, depending on your interpretation of quantum theory, then there has to be an observer at the start of the universe.
Right.
Right? So this is one of the theories of quantum gravity.
Oh, I see.
So how embedded is consciousness in the structure of the universe?
Exactly.
Actually, we've got at the conference we're coming up in Perth,
mm-hmm.
One of the speakers is Professor blah blah blah, his name I've forgotten, who was actually he knew Atul Brahm from when he was in Cambridge and studying physics, and they kept in touch and he's coming out and giving a talk,
mm-hmm.
and that's precisely what he's giving a talk about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's talking about that idea from quantum
theory.
Of
the theory. Observer at the start of the universe,
whether or not. That consciousness is inherent in the structure of the universe. Yeah.
As an observing factor.
Yeah, how that's interpreted. See, the thing with quantum theory is that the mathematics of quantum theory are very well understood. Right? It's a very rigorous and very reliable and accurate theory, and it's been tested for nearly 100 years now. It's always been extremely precise. But the interpretation of it is very, very weird. Right? So you have all of these many worlds theories and things like that. And people are trying to wrap their heads around it,
mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of divergence among scientists about what quantum theory means. And I suspect it won't be until maybe we take another sort of level of understanding,
mm-hmm.
that people will get more sort of agreement about that.
Mm-hmm.
They've just cranked up the particle accelerator at CERN to the full power. So they'll spend a few years analysing those results.
Yes.
Maybe something will come out of that.
Yeah.
There's been an interesting theory. I didn't really read it. Didn't take enough time reading it to sort of really fully digest it. But there is a new interpretation of quantum theory, which comes out, which is very interesting, and which goes probably even more further in that direction of putting consciousness in the centre of things, even compared to the traditional
Copenhagen. So many of the physics professors and mathematicians at a very high level discount consciousness. They forget about consciousness. They're so excited about what they're finding, I think.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's, this is one of the things that they say, that you follow up far enough and there it is peering back at you.
Yeah.
And you're like, what are you doing here? You know? They weren't expecting it, but then they couldn't exclude it.
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, that idea, because the whole basis of the scientific method is that you can have an observer who's separate from what they're observing.
Exactly.
And then you go there and you realize, actually, no, you can't. Yeah.
Well, for the mere fact that he's coming to a Buddhist conference means that he's leaning in that direction.
Yeah.
And he's a friend of Ajahn Brahm.
So yeah.
That's promising.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But there's quite a lot of physicists. Physicists tend to be a bit less hardcore materialists compared to biologists and even psychologists in many cases. Yeah. I think they're less nervous about it.
You see why I said the first line.
They know that they're a real science and they don't have to defend it.
Because in that first line, sorry to go ahead,
yeah,
but it's to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness. So
right.
I'm reading that as we don't have to worry about why. We just have to worry about our own consciousness, level of consciousness, and that it's increasing rather than decreasing.
Okay, can I do my thing on that paragraph,
yeah.
and then we'll see what implications
yes.
that has, okay? So we're now at that last paragraph in the refrain, and this is, I have to say, from my point of view, this last paragraph is the most dodgy paragraph of them all, and I strongly suspect that there is... With the previous one, it's a straightforward paragraph. I'm just not sure that it's meant to belong in that place. Whereas with this one, it seems to me that the Pali text itself is quite confused, and I think there must be some corruption somewhere. I'm not exactly sure how. Anyway, so it says, mindfulness has established that there is a body. Ati kayo divapanasa satipatipatita poti. Why is mindfulness established that there is a body? The body exists. I don't know. It's very weird. I mean, elsewhere in the suttas, the Buddha sort of takes a kind of anti-essentialist stance, right? He says, if you say everything exists, then this is an extreme. Well, here we're not saying that everything exists, but saying the body exists. But why are we saying the body exists? I don't quite get it. And I know that there are various ways of explaining it, but I've never found them to be very convincing. And then it goes on to say, to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness, so establishing mindfulness for the sake of mindfulness? Again, I don't find that very coherent. Normally you say, well, you establish mindfulness in order to, you know, lead to understanding or lead to release or lead to something else, but to say you're establishing mindfulness for the sake of mindfulness. The whole phrase is a little bit weird. Yava deva jnana mataya patisati mataya. Yava deva is like only so far off, or to the extent that. Isn't necessary, but then it has this ending, matta, which normally means mere or sufficient or only as much as, something like that. It's like a limiting word. So for sufficient knowledge, for mere knowledge and mindfulness, I don't know. I think I suspect that there's some textual corruption. I looked at that in quite a lot of detail when I was doing my study on Satipatthana, and I compared it with all the different versions. And it seemed that there was, you know, many different ideas there, but I couldn't really sort it out. So personally, I'm kind of reluctant to read too much into that passage. I'm not sure that we can get a coherent meaning out of it. The next line, they meditate independent, anisito cha viharati, not grasping at anything in the world, nacchinci loke upadiyati. That one is kind of more straightforward, so that you're just meditating, practicing without attachment. Elsewhere in the suttas it says nisi kasta chalitam, right? So the one who has dependencies is fragile, is vulnerable. Okay, and so if you're independent, then you're not so vulnerable. And so the stream enterer is also regarded as one who is aparapachaya, who's not dependent on another. Right? So this is this idea that by understanding and by practicing this meditation, that you get that strength inside yourself. So that you're not dependent on conditions of the world. You're not attached to getting this and having this. I'm going to be happy if I can get this and I can have this. You're happy because you're happy inside yourself. And this is something which comes from letting go. So this is what that I think that passage is pointing towards. So it finishes off this too, is how a monastic meditates by observing an aspect of the body.